significantly hindered construction projects in the country and pushed most Syrians below the poverty line, only due to their commitment to resistance and rejection of normalization with the Israeli regime.
Economic sanctions may serve as a pressure tactic, but they cannot alter the political course, especially when imposed on countries like Syria and Iran, or resistance movements that are ready to make any sacrifices for their causes. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
As the world celebrated 30 years since the end of apartheid in South Africa, protesters assembled in their thousands in London calling for an end to the Israeli apartheid and echoing the global demand for a ceasefire in Gaza.
We are here to call for the victory of the Palestinian struggle, that for us it means the end of this genocidal war against Gaza, against the West Bank for us, and against all the Palestinian people.
It's not in our name. We are selling, England is selling arms to Israel, and it's got to stop. They're creating genocide, and we don't want any part of it.
At the destination of the march in Hyde Park, speaker after speaker, including Northern Ireland's First Minister Michelle O'Neill, called out the American, European and British governments' complicity in the Israeli regime's crimes. The march came only weeks after the British Prime Minister gave a Downing Street address condemning extremism and saying the protests risked descending into mob rule, and his counter-extremism commissioner claimed London was becoming a no-go zone for Jews on Saturdays. That received pushback from a number of Jewish community leaders and members. And so the tussle between pro-Palestine marchers exercising their freedom of speech and those who want to cancel those marches continue.
The main theme of this protest, as with the previous ones, the killing of so many civilians in the Gaza Strip and the continued UK military and diplomatic support for the Israeli regime. There's also an element of defiance, too, to all the attempts that have been made to disrupt and to antagonize these protests. The protesters here are saying they aren't going anywhere and that they will be coming back again and again as long as the massacre continues. Saeed Pour is up, London.
In South Korea Saturday, protesters of U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza marched past the U.S. Embassy and through Seoul's downtown. Abuse and arrests of pro-Palestinian demonstrators at American colleges resonated with South Korean students.
Politicians and the media, in their attempt to justify such a crackdown, slander the Palestinian Solidarity Movement as spreading anti-Semitism. But history will remember them as accomplices in genocide.
This is the 32nd rally of South Korea's people in solidarity with Palestine, protesting against Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. As more and more reports surface outlining Israeli atrocities there, concern here grows over the situation in Rafah and Israel's increasing attacks against civilians there.
Participants call for a stoppage to Israel's imminent ground invasion of Rafah. At Seoul National University, a professor is under investigation for defacing a pro-Palestine poster after harassing a student. Such pressure tactics are seen by some demonstrators as an opportunity to set the record straight.
The professor, who's a Zionist, obviously, is trying to silence our voices about speaking up about against the genocide that is happening in Gaza and the occupation of Palestine. But at the same time, I feel like this is a chance for us to raise more awareness about what is happening and about why Zionism is, you know, why Zionism is bad.
Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the United States became even more isolated, vetoing the April 18th resolution to extend full membership to Palestine, with several U.S. allies, including South Korea, voting in favor. Frank Smith, Seoul.
While most Syrians are suffering from difficult economic conditions due to unlawful sanctions imposed by the United States and its Western allies, The U.S. has intensified its theory of Syrian resources from the areas it illegally occupies in eastern Euphrates. Civil sources from Al-Yarubiya in the Hasaka countryside reported that the U.S. occupation forces have transported dozens of trucks and tanks loaded with wheat, gas and oil to its bases in Iraqi territory in the past few weeks.
According to the Ministry of Oil, the total losses in the energy sector until 2022 amounted to more than $107 billion, including over $24 billion from oil and gas theft, over $3 billion due to infrastructure destruction, and over $80 billion in indirect losses resulting from the necessity of compensating for the missing resources through imports.
The U.S. occupies Syrian territory under the pretext of fighting the Daesh terrorist group, which Washington itself created.
The United States claimed to establish an international coalition to fight Daesh, while in fact they assassinated those who defeated this organization and fought for the freedom and safety of the Syrian people, including the martyred Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and several Iranian generals, in addition to targeting the Syrian Arab army.
Syrians believe that the main reason for the United States' occupation of Syrian territories is the theft of its wealth and the destruction of its infrastructure. Syrians say the U.S. wants to weaken the state and its army, but furthermore to push the Syrian people away from Palestine and the excess of resistance in order to protect the Israeli regime.
They're doing this just to increase the siege around the Syrian people, to suffocate the Syrian people more, to increase their suffering, and plus trying to diminish the Syrian role among the resistance countries in the region.
Syria's government, as well as other countries, have repeatedly condemned the ongoing violations by the U.S. as they blatantly steal Syrian wealth before the whole world without consequences, violating all international laws and forcing over 90% of the Syrian people to live below the poverty line, according to UN.
Despite the unjust Western sanctions on Syria, the theft of its national resources and the occupation of its land, the Syrian people's commitment to the Palestinian cause has grown stronger. Syrians are also determined to expel the U.S. and Israeli occupiers through resistance. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Amid rising tensions in the international waterways and the departure of several Western warships from the Red Sea, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities across the country in yet another strong show of support for Palestine.
We took to the streets to protest for the women and children who are being killed by American and British weapons. Our naval forces will firmly continue operations as long as the aggression against the people of Gaza continues. And if the Yemenis are given the opportunity, there will be thousands of them rushing to fight for Palestine.
The Yemeni people are supporting and standing with our brothers in Gaza, and no sanction or action by United States and the United Kingdom will stop the Yemeni people. Yemeni people in Sana'a and other city continue and demonstrate weekly.
Protesters endorsed the Yemeni army's recent naval operations against Israeli-bound ships. They urged their armed forces to continue attacking the Israeli regime and its Western benefactors.
We support our naval and aerial forces operations, and we urge the army to continue destroying the enemies and do not allow any American, British or Israeli ship to pass through our waters. Our army has targeted more than 100 ships, and the number will double unless the killing of the people of Gaza stops. We are ready to go and fight for the Palestinians in Gaza, and we promise that we can make Israel disappear.
In the latest development, the Yemeni army spokesman announced the targeting of the Israeli ship MSC Darwin in the Gulf of Aden with multiple drones and naval missiles. The Yemeni armed forces have also launched several ballistic missiles toward the Israeli-occupied city of Eilat.
Every week, Yemenis hold fresh rallies across the country to express their solidarity with Palestinians amid the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. People here vow that they will continue their support for Palestinians until the full liberation of the occupied territories. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana.
On Friday, a new national transport strike caused major disruptions in several Italian cities, including Rome, Milan and Naples. The four-hour industrial action called by the trade union FISA-CONFIL affected local bus, metro and tram services, with strike timetables varying from city to city. The strike coincided with the super long weekend of April 25th, or Liberation Day, a time when tourists flock to Italian cities. CONFIL FISA said that the nationwide strike is in protest over a number of issues ranging from job security and better working conditions to safety in the workplace.
Decades of wild privatization policies and budget cuts due to austerity measures have resulted in an overall precarization of the labor market. Workers' rights have been eroded, with severe consequences on wage security and living conditions.
The public transport sector, together with the health sector, has been the number one victim of budget cuts by consecutive governments under the pretext of promoting efficiency in the public administration. This strategy has not worked, as the current little public funding of private transport groups has to include a profit for the group itself. Thousands of bus drivers have been bearing the brunt for this enormous budget downsize. They work more hours for less money. A bus driver earns roughly 1,600 euros a month, but half of their pay goes into house rent or loan repayments.
And then there is the economic crisis that is plaguing Italy. Italians are grappling with serious economic hardships. The cost of living due to high inflation and high energy prices is biting hard in Italy, with an increasing number of families struggling to make ends meet. At the end of 2023, the number of people living in absolute poverty rose to almost 6 million, about 10% of the population, its highest level in about a decade. This, as about 6 more million Italians live in a state of relative poverty.
Our institutions are covering up the reality of the situation. All prices have been dramatically going up since the start of the war in Ukraine. The cost of fuel and that of tomatoes, vegetables, have gone up big time. What have not gone up is salaries and wages for the vast majority of the population.
Earlier this week, the European Parliament adopted a reform of the EU's rules for national debt and deficits. Some analysts have slammed these new rules, saying that they will once again impose a fiscal straitjacket on member states' national budgets, promoting short-term thinking and not safeguarding public investment in social welfare. Max Civili, Turin.
As Iran marks the anniversary of the failed U.S. military operation in the central Tabas Desert, people in the country say the Sands were the agents of God. A memorial ceremony was held in the capital, Tehran, with the event highlighting the budged American operation in which U.S. choppers crashed in the desert.
On April 24, 1980, the U.S. military carried out a cover operation in Iran by the order of President Jim Carter. The operation, dubbed Eagle's Claw, failed due to major sandstorms in the central Tabas Desert. The failed operation resulted in the death of American soldiers. Iranians believe the sands were the agents of God.
The botched American mission was an attempt to release 52 staff of the U.S. Embassy, known as the Den of Espionage, who had been held after the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
The incident of Tabas was a helping hand from the Almighty God to defend the great nation of Iran. And also the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, said the sands were appointed by God. Even the sand rose in support of the Iranian nation. And that bitter incident happened to the American regime.
Unlike the previous years, this year's memorial isn't just a history lesson. It is also an opportunity to reflect on Iran's recent anti-Israel retaliatory attack, dubbed Operation True Promise, which showed the true power of Iran's military forces. Since the failed U.S. Operation Eagle Claw, Iran has boosted and upgraded its defense capabilities and can now stand up to all kinds of threats.
casualties and civilians, we will not hesitate to retaliate from our own land. The True Promise operation was executed in a specific manner which is classified right now. We use scores of drones, crews, and ballistic missiles with proper timing to successfully penetrate the complicated Israeli air defense systems and strike our targets with pinpoint accuracy.
Iran has shown that threats from its enemies have only strengthened its will to defend what belongs to the nation. And now, it seems that the West has woken up to Iran's military powers after Operation True Promise.
Reza Hashemi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. How dystopian is it that we are approaching the seventh month of an ongoing genocide as the Israeli regime bombs and starves the Palestinian population? Instead of making the regime end its genocide, we have food drops and some aid drizzling in. Meanwhile, the U.S. regime is building a pier to allegedly help get more aid into northern Gaza. How about just stopping the genocide? Well, as governments around the world ignore the genocide, the voices of the people of the world are growing louder. They want the genocide to end now. We're going to take a look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Budapest, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, George Samuli. Out of Oslo, Professor of Political Science, University of Southeastern Norway, Glenn Deason. Thank you both for being with me. Starting it off with George in Budapest. I mean, since the beginning of this Holocaust, governments around the world have said that Israel must respect human lives, must respect civilian lives, just as international organizations have called on the regime to be careful. But, of course, these were just words which followed no actions. I mean, why did they put on this performance to begin with? And where are we now with that? Is it obvious now that all of this was a mask, or how do you see it?
Well, I think we know how Israel behaves. It's been behaving like this for almost 80 years. It was obvious after October the 7th what Israel would do, how it would do it. The ruthlessness with which Israel would act, the lack of any human compassion, all that is familiar from Israeli actions in the past. What I find surprising is not so much the almost unconditional support offered by the United States, because again, that's par for the course from what we've seen in the past. But the almost unconditional support from Europe. I mean, there has been some dissent in Europe, but nothing comparable to the dissent that used to exist in Europe. I mean, I remember Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982. That generated a lot of opposition in Europe from European governments. This time, it's been absent. And many European governments, the British government, the German government, have been wholeheartedly supportive of Israel. And that, I think, has surprised me.
Well, Glenn, as more governments have been impotent increasingly, people around the world have been protesting against the genocide. Does this show that there is a major disconnect between people and their governments? And how likely is this to backfire on these regimes?
Yeah, well, we've seen that over the past few years, a growing disconnect, as you said. This is part of the reason why there's a populist uprising. So populism, by definition, being when new political actors emerge, which then express their, which rise on the distance between the people and the public. And I think this is quite well deserved. Again, it's not just on social issues and economic, but we now especially see it in terms of foreign policy. As we've seen in the United States, people want, for example, peace and negotiations in Ukraine. The government does not. But obviously, the most startling or specific example would be the massacres now taking place in Gaza, as there's huge protests, not just in the United States, but Europe as well, in which people really want an end to this. But again, the U.S. and Israel keeps pushing for for this genocide, and the Europeans seems to simply be following along the United States. Why the Europeans are so compliant now, I think there's a variety of reasons, but one of them, of course, could be that given there's a war in Europe, the Europeans feel more vulnerable and even more dependent on the Americans. I guess Europeans are even more willing to bend, take the knee to the United States and effectively do as they're told. So I would agree the fact that the EU was able to say that they support the ceasefire on the condition that Hamas dismantles itself and surrenders, I mean, essentially capitulating, that this was the condition for ending the massacres. This is nothing short of being complicit. And as we see with Western European governments, they're also willing to crack down on any protesters who are protesting what is now very seemingly a genocide. So this is not a good look for Europe.
Yeah, indeed not. It's quite mind-boggling in many ways when we see what has happened to Europe. But, George, university students in the United States and of course, other countries now are protesting against the genocide and supporting Palestinians. Why has the American regime specifically come down so hard on university students protesting?
Well, because here we've got the politicians. It's the politicians who are putting the pressure on the government. They are in hock to the Israel lobby. The Israel lobby is extremely powerful, and very few politicians at all dare to defy it. The few who have defied it nearly always get themselves into serious trouble and electoral disaster. So there is that. What's interesting is the attitude of the university presidents. Now, the university presidents took a very tolerant attitude towards the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020 and allowed campus sit-ins and students skipping class and so on. They're taking a very different approach now. And here again, as with the politicians, money talks, because many of these universities are dependent on donations from their alumni. And many of their alumni are passionately devoted to the cause of Israel, and the donors as well. And so the donors have made clear that unless you crack down on these protests, we will start withholding funds. And the university presidents also then listen to the government, and many of these universities are again dependent on grants, awards from governments, from all the government agencies, whether it's the Pentagon, whether it's the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation. There's a lot of money that pours into universities. And if they're suddenly faced with the prospect of having no money coming in, then that's a very serious business. You know, their laboratories are going to close down. They have to forget about building a new basketball court. So, they're told, hey, you need to crack down on these protests, and they do it. Mm-hmm. You know, money counts for a lot more than the First Amendment, free speech, or anything like that.
Well, Glenn, university protests started at Columbia University, and that university's officials have said that the institution will not divest from Israel, which is one of the demands of the students. I mean, what is Columbia saying by doing this? Is Columbia and other universities basically saying that they stand for genocide and that they openly support the Israeli regime? Or your assessment of what this means?
Well, they were put in a difficult situation, because usually what would happen in instances like this is, they give their full support to Israel, demonize dissenters, portray anyone opposing this or standing up for the human rights of Palestinians to be, anti-Semites or terrorists or Islamists. And then, a few weeks, this would all go away. The problem now is that this has been this very slow drip-drip growing from massacre to ethnic cleansing to genocide. And it's been going on now for more than half a year, and I think it's they can't really withdraw from their previous position either. So I think they're just keep hardening their former position. And obviously, it's not a good look, but they can't really go against Israel either. And, as George pointed out, they do have immense influence. So at the end of the day, this is what they end up doing. They're looking to construct a somewhat convincing narrative to support what is a position which more and more people are finding to be quite appalling.
Well, staying with you, you just mentioned, Glenn, you said that position that to more and more people, it's quite appalling. One would think that anyone with any type of humanity would be quite appalled at the scenes of newborn babies being pulled from under rubble, with kids and losing limbs. I mean, we won't even deal with the men and not even the women, but just the kids. It's amazing, this disconnect, Glenn, with what you just said, that that it becomes money over lives. It becomes because of donations. You ignore all of this inhumanity for dollars.
And I guess it's the hypocrisy quite stands out as well, because in the beginning of this war, there was this fake news where they said that the Hamas had placed babies in ovens, this kind of 40 babies, I think. It was proven to be fake. Right. It was eventually revoked. But as we saw, the uproar this caused in the West were essentially giving Israel full support to do whatever it wanted. This huge uproar doesn't really apply to the Palestinians. I find this quite disturbing. One has to ask, therefore, well, what actual principles do we have here if the Palestinians' lives aren't doesn't matter the same? So I share your sentiment. I've had enough seeing dead babies being pulled out of rubble. This is horrific. So, and it's quite the repercussions for the West is also quite immense, because liberalism and liberal ideals, human rights, were supposed to be the defining principles of the collective West, the foundation of our common identity. And as we now see all these dead children, babies being pulled out of rubble, and our first impulse is to make excuses and try to make it go away, it could have real consequences for how the West would see itself in the future, how the public would perceive their own countries. So.
Right. Well, what about that, George? I mean, is the whole liberal international order on the verge of collapsing as the real face of these liberal regimes are becoming clearer?
Well, I'm not sure the liberal international order ever was a serious concept. It's more.
Well, they kept a pretty good facade, at least.
But it was a facade. I mean, again, people remember. Well, I certainly remember the Vietnam War. I mean, the scale of the destruction at the time was quite mind-boggling. I mean, right. But again, when we did have some protests in the United States, but the protests were very narrowly focused. I mean, basically. Young Americans didn't want to be drafted and sent to Vietnam for understandable reasons, but there was very little concern for the millions of Vietnamese who were killed. And we've seen this time and again that the liberal international order is very good on rhetoric, absolutely makes great speeches, but in terms of observing human rights norms, it's never really bothered with that. I mean, the case of Israel is paradigmatic in this case, because we've known all these years of what Israel has done, from the foundation of Israel to all the wars that Israel has waged against its neighbors, to the invasion of Lebanon. We can just go on and on and on. And basically, the West, chiefly the United States, because the United States is overwhelmingly the leader of the West, has turned a blind eye of all of the contemptuous treatment of United Nations Security Council resolutions, or shrugged their shoulders. But you know, when it comes to governments that the West doesn't like, whether it's the government in Moscow, whether it's in Tehran, or whether it's Pyongyang, then suddenly the West is, you know, in high dudgeon, making great speeches, you know, human rights, you know, our values, this, values, that. So it's always been insincere, you know, for many, many years. I mean, so, you know, it's, I don't think it's collapsing now. I don't think there was ever much substance to it.
Hmm. Well, what about, Glenn, George talked about the protests during the Vietnam era. I want to look at the comparison because, as he said, these individuals were basically protesting because American lives were being lost, not necessarily just because of the Vietnamese being killed. This time around, we see quite a different dynamics with these American students protesting against this genocide that's taking place on the other side of the world. They could also detach and just say, it doesn't involve me, but they are very much involved. I mean, does that say something about perhaps a new reality, a new sense of awareness with these young people?
Yes, I think so. Well, obviously the Vietnam War was quite unique in its own day, given that this was really the first war when the war was brought into people's living rooms as well, where the media exposed to a large extent some of the horrors which were committed. But today it's an even greater scale, I would say, with anyone can pick up their phone and look at the horrific crimes being committed every single day. So I do think that in the risk of sounding like a cliche, that the world has become a much smaller, and suddenly the massacres in Gaza are feeling a lot closer to us than it was in the past. So I think there's many parallels that can definitely be drawn, but it's also not just what's happening in Gaza, but it's also the reactions here. Because when we have all this protest, we see videos coming out of America, Germany, France, where the police are essentially beating up protesters and pulling them away. In Germany, they had a conference in Berlin, and the former finance minister of Greece was banned from entering the country. He was banned from even delivering a speech over Zoom or even playing a pre-recorded speech. This is quite extraordinary. This every day it seems like some basic rights are being chipped away, and it's quite concerning.
Well, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell has said that by next month, several European countries may recognize Palestinian statehood. I mean, what do you think about that, George?
I'll believe it when I see it. I think that's just a lot of talk. We've heard this kind of talk before. David Cameron, the UK Foreign Secretary, hinted at a couple of months ago that the UK was ready to sign off on Palestinian statehood. The EU is essentially is a pretty solid block there. They don't really allow individual member states to conduct their own independent foreign policy. I mean, there's an EU foreign policy, a NATO foreign policy. They're not just going to allow individual member states to recognize the state of Palestine. They might go somewhere, you know, like in theory, you know, maybe someday when everything is sorted out and there's a ceasefire, then, you know, maybe then we will recognize a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. But it will be left, I think, at the theoretical level. I don't think they're actually going to go ahead and say, we now recognize it, we're ready to conduct diplomatic exchanges. So I just don't think it's going to happen.
Well, Glenn, as Western countries continue to show inaction regarding the genocide, the resistance front continues with their attacks on the Zionist regime. Just in the last few days, more operations have been carried out by the Yemeni military, by Hezbollah. Do you think that there is a growing global awareness of who is really friend and who is foe now in this fight against the Zionists and their supporters?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think this conflict has really put into place when countries have to show if they actually abide by the values which they proclaim that they support. And so I do think that it has been quite revealing, the extent to which some countries not only don't want to condemn Israel, but actively supporting it. And I think this also, it is quite clear, because usually there's an effort to cover up a little bit. And I think this is also what George referred to as there's often an interest to express a lot of sympathy, send some aid, pretend as if one is upholding these values, and then just wait until the whole thing goes away. And of course, promising possible recognition of Palestine, it could fall into the same category. I know there's a huge amount of the population from Spain to and Ireland who are considering it, but and also I think Norway was willing perhaps to give some vague commitments as well if the Irish and the Spanish went forth. But it's never clear if this is genuine, because it reminds me a bit of what the United States is doing. You know, they're expressing all this concern for the Palestinians, they're insisting that Israel constrain itself, but they would never actually reduce the supply of bombs which are dropping on the heads of the Palestinians. You know, they're sending in this aid dropped from the sky, which is, you know, a small drop in the bucket, while they have all these trucks standing outside which aren't allowed in. And it doesn't seem very authentic. If the United States would want this war to end, they could end it today. This is an American war as much as it is an Israeli war. And so I think a lot of this is managing the narrative and working on the PR. But again, people, I don't dispute that some have genuine concerns as well. So, but it's very hard to recognize when there's a genuine interest in making some real changes and when it's just narrative building, effectively.
Right. Well, George, there are ceasefire talks taking place once again in Egypt. What will it take to bring about a ceasefire to Gaza, in your perspective?
Well, it's very hard to know at this stage how close we really are to a ceasefire. If one just go by what the current media report, it suggests that Israel has made fairly substantial concessions. Again, I don't necessarily take this seriously, but the story that they're ready to settle for the release of 34 hostages, that they're ready to withdraw some Israeli forces, they're ready to allow residents of northern Gaza to return, they will obviously release a large number of Palestinian prisoners. It sounds pretty good. However, you know, I'm also very very skeptical about these stories. Look, I mean, you know, as I think Glenn was suggesting, the key here is the United States. There would be a ceasefire, you know, within an hour, if the United States called Benjamin Netanyahu and said, "That's it, we're done, we've had enough, we're not going to supply you with anything else." But in fact, the United States is giving the opposite message. You know, last week they signed off on this massive bumper package, $26 billion for Israel. Why? What has Israel done to deserve this? And, you know, there are all, you know, all these caveats. Oh, well, they have to use it like this, they have to use it like that. But we all know that, of course, Israel will use the weapons exactly the way Israel wants to. So the United States doesn't have any leverage over Israel, because the United States doesn't want to have any leverage over Israel. It can wring its hands. Anyone can do that. But basically, where it counts, the United States does nothing.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. We're out of time. George Samueli, a senior research fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, out of Budapest, and Glenn Diesen, a professor of political science, University of Southeastern Norway, out of Oslo. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
Praising the people and government of Pakistan and Pakistan's firm stance against Israel, the Iranian president Said Ibrahim Raisi has said the two countries have a common stance on the Palestinian issue. We take a look at the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Amid heightened regional tensions and shifting alliances, Iranian President Said Ibrahim Raisi's first official visit to Pakistan recently was historic and opened a new chapter in Iran-Pakistan ties. The significance of this visit is best illustrated by veiled warnings issued by the United States to Pakistan, warning against trade deals with Iran and threatening potential sanctions against Islamabad. The three-day landmark visit concluded with the two countries announcing plans to raise the volume of trade between them to $10 billion per year over the next 5 years, up from the current $2 billion a year. Many documents regarding cooperation were signed by officials of the two sides in the presence of Iranian President Said Ibrahim Raisi and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif. The agreements concerned trade, science and technology, agriculture, healthcare, culture, as well as legal and judicial affairs. The key objective of the visit from Iran's perspective was to strengthen economic ties with neighboring Pakistan through discussions on economic, commercial, energy and border cooperation. This was in line with President Ibrahim Raisi's neighborhood first policy. From Pakistan's perspective, the visit provided an opportunity for Islamabad to expand its cooperation with Tehran in areas of common interest and to resolve various misunderstandings. The visit was particularly seen as an attempt by the two Muslim-majority neighboring countries to mend fences following missile launches from both sides in January. Sayed Ali, a financial analyst based in Pakistan, told Press TV that the visit was significant as it came months after cross-border attacks on terrorist camps, making it crucial for restoring normal relations between Tehran and Islamabad. Importantly, the Iranian president's visit to Pakistan was announced soon after the top diplomats of the two countries held talks to allay the concerns of each other arising from the missile strikes. The visit furthered Pakistan and Iran's efforts to reduce tensions and strengthen security cooperation. Both countries pledged to combat terrorism within their borders and establish a system of ministerial-level consultations to oversee progress across multiple sectors. Khawaja Burhan, a journalist and analyst based in Karachi, Pakistan, echoed this sentiment, describing the visit as a breath of fresh air amidst tensions fueled by ongoing West Asia conflict. Despite Western saber-rattling, Khawaja Burhan emphasized the potential benefits of completing ambitious projects such as the gas pipeline and free trade agreements and asserted that both nations could greatly benefit if they capitalize on the current momentum for cooperation. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department on Tuesday, 23rd of April, warned the Pakistani government against dealing with Iran. In a news briefing, a spokesperson, Vardhan Patel, referred to the potential risk in engaging with Iran. The State Department spokesman, Vardhan Patel, said, "We advise anyone considering business deals with Iran to be aware of the potential risks of sanctions, but ultimately the government of Pakistan can speak to their own foreign policy pursuits." However, Pakistan's Foreign Office stated that the two nations reached an agreement to collaborate in energy domain encompassing electricity, trade, power transmission, infrastructure, and the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. The gas pipeline project has been stalled for over 10 years because of political instability and global sanctions. The pipeline was initially planned to extend over 1,900 kilometers from Iran's South Pass gas field to Pakistan, aiming to fulfill Pakistan's increasing energy demands. Recently, Pakistani authorities signaled their intention to request a waiver from the United States for the pipeline's construction on Pakistan's soil, whilst rejecting American opposition to the project. Analyst Mohammad Faisal said the threat of sanctions from the United States is primarily aimed at deterring Pakistan and raising the costs of business engagement with Iran. Iranian President Said Ibrahim Raisi said strengthening cooperation between the two nations as two important Muslim countries in the region can play an effective role in solving regional problems. He hastened to add that the presence of foreigners in the region only compounds problems in this region. Iran's Tasnim news agency has also covered the same story. Praising the people and government of Pakistan and Pakistan's firm stance against the Israeli regime, Iranian President Said Ibrahim Raisi said the two countries have a common stance on the Palestinian issue. President Raisi also warned that an Israeli attack on Iranian soil would result in a drastic change in the situation, including the complete dissolution of the Zionist regime. During meetings, both Islamabad and Tehran strongly condemned the Israeli regime's escalating aggression against Palestinians, particularly in the Gaza Strip. Both nations condemned the devastating humanitarian consequences of the Gaza genocide, including mounting casualties and the displacement of millions of Palestinians. The two countries demanded an immediate ceasefire, unhindered humanitarian access to Gaza, the repatriation of displaced Palestinians, and justice for Israeli war crimes committed in Gaza. They emphasized their support for a just, comprehensive, and long-term resolution that aligns with Palestinian aspirations and struggle against the Israeli regime. Iranian President Said Ibrahim Raisi urged all Muslim countries to forge unity, saying Israel is committing crimes against the oppressed people of Palestine because of a lack of unity and solidarity among Muslims. He told a gathering of elites in Islamabad, Pakistan, "What is more lamentable is that the United States, Britain, and Western countries support these atrocities, and the international organizations who claim to defend human rights have lost their efficacy to stop these crimes." Pakistan's Prime Minister, Shahbaz Sharif, for his part, hailed Iran's steadfastness in supporting the liberation of the city of Al-Quds and defending the oppressed Palestinian people from the Israeli occupation. Shahbaz Sharif asserted unity and coherence among Muslim countries will be the most important element to deter Israel from committing more crimes against Palestinians. Iranian President Said Ibrahim Raisi's tour of Pakistan, apart from high-level meetings in Islamabad with President Asif Ali Zardari and Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, included a visit to Lahore in Punjab and to the city of Karachi in Sindh province. In Lahore, President Raisi met Punjab's chief minister, Maryam Nawaz, and governor, Baligur Rahman, focusing on cultural exchanges. He also visited Allama Iqbal Lahouri's museum in Sialkot, showing his affinity with Pakistani people and culture, and delivered a lecture at Lahore University. In Karachi, President Ibrahim Raisi discussed economic opportunities with senior authorities in Karachi, vowing to enhance technological exchanges and remove trade barriers between Iran and Pakistan.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Nearly 50 Palestinians are killed in Israel's latest strikes across the Gaza Strip as the death toll for the regime's campaign of genocide exceeds 34,500. UN chief describes Israel's planned invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah as an unbearable escalation, saying it will kill thousands more civilians. and New York City police officers enter Columbia University, arresting students who've been holding pro-Palestinian rallies for nearly 2 weeks. Our top story, there is no end in sight to Israeli genocide in Gaza as innocent civilians, including women and children, continue falling victims to Israeli